Chapter 29. Licentious ecclesiastic was common enough, but Odo had never before met a priest who united serious piety with his indulgent temper, or who had learning enough to do justice to the arguments of his opponents. On his venturing one evening to compliment De Crucis on these qualities, the latter replied with a smile, "Whatever has been lately advanced against the Jesuits, it can hardly be denied that they were good schoolmasters, and it is to them I owe the talents you have been pleased to admire. Indeed," he continued, quietly fingering his violin, "I was myself bred in the order, a fact I do not often make known in the present heated state of public opinion, but which I never conceal when commended for any quality that I owe to the society, rather than to my own merit." Surprise for the moment silenced Odo, for though it was known that Italy was full of former Jesuits who had been permitted to remain in the country as secular priests, and even to act as tutors or professors in private families, he had never thought of De Crucis in this connection. The latter, seeing his surprise, went on, "Once a Jesuit, always a Jesuit, I suppose. I at least owe the society too much not to own my debt when the occasion offers. Nor could I ever see the force of the charge so often brought against us, that we sacrifice everything to the glory of the order. For what is the glory of the order? Our own motto has declared it. Ad majorem Dei gloriam, who works for the society works for its master. If our zeal has been sometimes misdirected, our blood has a thousand times witnessed to its sincerity. In the Indies, in America, in England during the Great Persecution, and lately on our own unnatural coasts, the Jesuits have died for Christ as joyfully as his first disciples died for him. Yet these are but a small number in comparison with the countless servants of the order who, laboring in far countries among savage peoples, or surrounded by the heretical enemies of our faith, have died the far bitterer death of moral isolation, setting themselves to their task with the knowledge that their lives were but so much indistinguishable dust to be added to the sum of human effort. What association founded on human interests has ever commanded such devotion? And what merely human authority could count on such unquestioning obedience, not in a mob of poor illiterate monks, but in men chosen for their capacity and trained to the exercise of their highest faculties? Yet there have never lacked such men to serve the order, and as one of our enemies has said, our noblest enemy, the great Pascal G. Croix volunteers aux histers dans les témoins si font eager. Apostrophe, he did not again revert to his connection with the Jesuits, but in the farther course of their acquaintance Odo was often struck by the firmness with which he testified to the faith that was in him, without using the jargon of piety, or seeming, by his own attitude, to cast a reflection on that of others. He was indeed master of that worldly science which the Jesuits excelled in imparting, and which, though it might sink to hypocrisy in smaller natures, became in a finely tempered spirit the very flower of Christian courtesy. Odo had often spoken to De Crucis of the luxurious lives led by many of the monastic orders in Naples. It might be true enough that the monks themselves, and even their abbots, fared on fish and vegetables, and gave their time to charitable and educational work, but it was impossible to visit the famous monastery of San Martino, or that of the Carthusians at Camaldoli, without observing that the anchorite's cell had expanded into a delightful apartment, with bedchamber, library and private chapel, and his cabbage plot into a princely garden. De Crucis admitted the truth of the charge, explaining it in part by the character of the Neapolitan people, and by the tendency of the northern traveler to forget that such apparent luxuries as spacious rooms, shady groves and the like are regarded as necessities in a hot climate. He urged, moreover, that the monastic life should not be judged by a few isolated instances. And on the way to Rome he proposed that Odo, by way of seeing the other side of the question, should visit the ancient foundation of the Benedictines on Monte Cassino. the venerable monastery, raised on its height over the busy vale of Garigliano, like some contemplative spirit above the conflicting problems of life, might well be held to represent the nobler side of Christian celibacy. For nearly 1,000 years its fortified walls had been the stronghold of the humanities, and generations of students had cherished and added to the treasures of the famous library. But the Benedictine rule was as famous for good works as for learning, and its comparative abstention from dogmatic controversy, and from the mechanical devotion of some of the other orders had drawn to it men of superior mind, who sought in the monastic life the free exercise of the noblest activities, rather than a sanctified refuge from action. This was especially true of the monastery of Monte Cassino, whither many scholars had been attracted, and where the fathers had long had the highest name for learning and beneficence. The monastery, moreover, in addition to its charitable and educational work among the poor, maintained a school of theology to which students came from all parts of Italy, and their presence lent an unwonted life to the great labyrinth of courts and cloisters. The abbot, with whom de Crucis was well acquainted, welcomed the travelers warmly, making them free of the library and the archives and pressing them to prolong their visit. Under the spell of these influences they lingered on from day to day, and to Odo they were the pleasantest days he had known. To be waked before dawn by the bell ringing for lauds, to rise from the narrow bed in his whitewashed cell, and opening his casement look forth over the haze-enveloped valley, the dark hills of the Abruzzi, and the remote gleam of sea touched into being by the sunrise, to hasten through hushed echoing corridors to the church, where in a gray resurrection light the fathers were intoning the solemn office of renewal this morning ablution of the spirit, so like the bodily plunge into clear cold water, seemed to attune the mind to the fullest enjoyment of what was to follow. The hours of study, the talks with the monks, the strolls through cloister or garden, all punctuated by the recurring summons to devotion. Yet for all its latent significance it remained to him a purely sensuous impression, the vision of a golden leisure. Not a solution of life's perplexities, but at best an honorable escape from them. 3.2. To know Rome is to have assisted at the councils of destiny. This cry of a more famous traveler must have struggled for expression in Odo's breast as the great city, the city of cities, laid her irresistible hold upon him. His first impression, as he drove in the clear evening light from the Porta del Popolo to his lodgings, in the Via Sistina, was of a prodigious accumulation of architectural effects, a crowding of century on century, all fused in the crucible of the Roman sun, so that each style seemed linked to the other by some subtle affinity of color. Nowhere else, surely, is the traveler's first sight so crowded with surprises, with conflicting challenges to eye and brain. Here, as he passed, was a fragment of the ancient Servian wall, there a new stucco shrine embedded in the bricks of a medieval palace, on one hand a lofty terrace crowned by a row of moldering busts, on the other a tower with machicolated parapet, its flanks encrusted with bits of Roman sculpture, and the escutcheons of 17th century popes. Opposite, perhaps, one of Fuga's golden-brown churches, with windy saints blowing out of their niches, overlooked the nereids of a Barocco fountain, or an old house propped itself like a palsied beggar against a row of Corinthian columns, while everywhere flights of steps led up and down to hanging gardens or under archways, and each turn revealed some distant glimpse of convent walls on the slope of a vineyard, or of red-brown ruins profiled against the dim sea-like reaches of the Campagna. Afterward, as order was born out of chaos, and he began to thread his way among the centuries, this first vision lost something of its intensity, yet it was always, to the last, through the eye, that Rome possessed him. Her life, indeed, as though in obedience to such a setting, was an external, a spectacular business, from the wild animation of the cattle market in the Forum, or the huckster's traffic among the fountains of the Piazza Navona, to the pompous entertainments in the cardinals' palaces, and the ever-recurring religious ceremonies and processions. Pius V, in the reaction from Ganganelli's democratic ways, had restored the pomp and ceremonial of the Vatican with the religious discipline of the Holy Office, and never perhaps had Rome been more splendid on the surface or more silent and empty within. Odo, at times, as he moved through some assemblage of cardinals and nobles, had the sensation of walking through a huge reverberating palace, decked out with all the splendors of art, but long since abandoned of men. The superficial animation, the taste for music and antiquities, all the dilettantisms of an idle and irresponsible society, seemed to him to shrivel to dust in the glare of that great past that lit up every corner of the present. Through his own connections, and the influence of De Crucis, he saw all that was best, not only among the nobility, but in that ecclesiastical life now more than ever predominant in Rome. Here at last he was face to face with the mighty Sphinx, and with the bleaching bones of those who had tried to guess her riddle. Wherever he went, these august adventurers walked the streets with him, gliding between the princes of the church in the ceremonies of St. Peter's and the Lateran, or mingling in the company that ascended the state staircase at some cardinal's levee. He met indeed many accomplished and amiable ecclesiastics, but it seemed to him that the more thoughtful among them had either acquired their peace of mind at the cost of a certain sensitiveness, or had taken refuge in a study of the past, as the early hermits fled to the desert from the disorders of Antioch and Alexandria. None seemed disposed to face the actual problems of life, and this attitude of caution or indifference had produced a stagnation of thought that contrasted strongly with the animation of Sir William Hamilton's circle in Naples. The result in Odo's case was a reaction toward the pleasures of his age, and of these Rome had but few to offer. He spent some months in the study of the antique, purchasing a few good examples of sculpture for the Duke, and then, without great reluctance, set out for Monte Loro. Here he found a changed atmosphere. The Duke welcomed him handsomely, and bestowed the highest praise on the rarities he had collected. But for the moment the court was ruled by a new favorite, to whom Odo's coming was obviously unwelcome. This adroit adventurer, whose name was soon to become notorious throughout Europe, had taken the old prince by his darling weaknesses, and Odo, having no mind to share in the excesses of the precious couple, seized the first occasion to set out again on his travels. His course had now become one of aimless wandering, for prudence still forbade his return to Pianura, and his patron's indifference left him free to come and go as he chose. He had brought from Rome that albergo dire a settled melancholy of spirit, which sought refuge in such distractions as the moment offered. In such a mood, change of scene was a necessity, and he resolved to employ the next months in visiting several of the mid-Italian cities. Toward Florence he was specially drawn by the fact that Alfieri now lived there. But, as often happens after such separations, the reunion was a disappointment. Alfieri, indeed, warmly welcomed his friend, but he was engrossed in his dawning passion for the Countess of Albany, and that lady's pitiable situation excluded all other interests from his mind. To Odo, to whom the years had brought an increasing detachment, this self-absorption seemed an arrest in growth, for Alfieri's early worship of liberty had not yet found its destined channel of expression, and for the moment his enthusiasms had shrunk to the compass of a romantic adventure. The friends parted after a few days of unsatisfying intercourse, and it was under the influence of this final disenchantment that Odo set out for Venice. It was the vintage season, and the travelers descended from the Apennines on a landscape diversified by the picturesque incidents of the grape gathering. On every slope stood some villa with awnings spread, and merry parties were picnicking among the vines, or watching the peasants at their work. Cantapresto, who had shown great reluctance at leaving Monte Loro, where, as he declared, he found himself as snug as an eel in a pasty, was now all eagerness to press forward, and Odo was in the mood to allow any influence to decide his course. He had an invaluable courier in Cantapresto, whose enormous pretensions generally assured him the best lodging and the fastest conveyance to be obtained, and who was never happier than when outwitting a rival emissary or bribing a landlord to serve upon Odo's table the repast ordered in advance for some distinguished traveler. His impatience to reach Venice, which he described as the scene of all conceivable delights, had on this occasion tripled his zeal, and they traveled rapidly to Padua, where he had engaged a burchiello for the passage down the Brenta. Here, however, he found he had been outdone at his own game, for the servant of an English duke had captured the burchiello and embarked his noble party before Cantapresto reached the wharf. This being the season of the villeggiatura, when the Venetian nobility were exchanging visits on the mainland, every conveyance was in motion, and no other boat to be had for a week, while as for the Isentor public bark, which was just then getting underway, it was already packed to the gunwale with Jews, peddlers and such vermin, and the captain swore by the 3,000 relics of St. Justina that he had no room on board for so much as a hungry flea. Odo, who had accompanied Cantapresto to the waterside, was listening to these assurances and to the soprano's vain invectives when a well-dressed young man stepped up to the group. This gentleman, whose accent and dress showed him to be a Frenchman of quality, told Odo that he was come from Vicenza, whither he had gone to engage a company of actors for his friend the Procurator Bra, who was entertaining a distinguished company at his villa on the Brenta, that he was now returning with his players, and that he would be glad to convey Odo so far on his road to Venice. His friend's seat, he added, was near Oriago, but a few miles above Fusina, where a public conveyance might always be found, so that Odo would doubtless be able to proceed the same night to Venice. This civil offer Odo at once accepted, and the Frenchman thereupon suggested that, as the party was to set out the next day at sunrise, the two should sup together and pass the intervening hours in such diversions as the city offered. They returned to the inn, where the actors were also lodged, and Odo's host, having ordered a handsome supper, proposed, with his guest's permission, to invite the leading members of the company to partake of it. He departed on this errand, and great was Odo's wonder when the door reopened, to discover, among the party it admitted, his old acquaintance of Vercelli, the Count of Castelravinato. The latter, whose dress and person had been refurbished, and who now wore an air of rakish prosperity, greeted him with evident pleasure, and, while their entertainer was engaged in seating the ladies of the company, gave him a brief account of the situation. The young French gentleman, whom he named as the Marquis de Kervoland, had come to Italy some months previously on the Grand Tour, and having fallen a victim to the charms of Venice, had declared that, instead of continuing on his travels, he meant to complete his education in that famous school of pleasure. Being master of his own fortune, he had hired a palace on the Grand Canal, had dispatched his governor, a simple archaeologist, on a mission of exploration to Sicily and Greece, and had devoted himself to an assiduous study of Venetian manners. Among those contributing to his instruction was Mirandolina of Chioggia, who had just completed a successful engagement at the Theater of San Moise in Venice. Wishing to detain her in the neighborhood, her adorer had prevailed on his friend the Procurator to give a series of comedies at his villa of Bellocchio, and had engaged to provide him with a good company of performers. Miranda was of course selected as prima amorosa, and the Marquess, under Castelravinato's guidance, had then set out to collect the rest of the company. This he had succeeded in doing, and was now returning to Bellocchio, where Miranda was to meet them. Odo was the more diverted at the hazard which had brought him into such company, as the Procurator Bra was one of the noblemen to whom the old duke had specially recommended him. On learning this, the Marquess urged him to present his letter of introduction on arriving at Bellocchio, where the procurator, who was noted for hospitality to strangers, would doubtless insist on his joining the assembled party. This Odo declined to do, but his curiosity to see Mirandolina made him hope that chance would soon throw him in the procurator's way. Meanwhile, supper was succeeded by music and dancing, and the company broke up only in time to proceed to the landing place, where their barge awaited them. This was a private burchiello of the procurator's with a commodious antecomer for the servants, and a cabin cushioned in damask. Into this agreeable retreat the actresses were packed with all their bags and bandboxes, and their traveling cloaks being rolled in two pillows, they were soon asleep in a huddle of tumbled finery. Odo and his host preferred to take the air on deck. The sun was rising above the willow-clad banks of the Brenta, and it was pleasant to glide in the clear early light past sleeping gardens and villas, and vineyards where the peasants were already at work. The wind setting from the sea, they traveled slowly, and at full leisure, to view the succession of splendid seats interspersed with gardens, the thriving villages, and the poplar groves festooned with vines. Kier Volant spoke eloquently of the pleasures to be enjoyed in this delightful season of the villeggiatura. "Nowhere," said he, "do people take their pleasures so easily and naturally as in Venice. My countrymen claim a superiority in this art." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.